quite unrelated to all of that. It really is fun when you win. This particular photograph from one of our beloved ducks took place only 2 months ago in an overtime win. He had just dunked the ball there, you know, and scored points that would contribute to that win. And so the exhilaration that you see there, the thrill that you see portrayed, you know, is quite obvious in every fiber of his being. It's just wonderful when you're on top, no denying it. But there's also no denying, brethren, that life is just not always very full and very fun in that bowl of cherries that we hear so much about and wish that every so often we might be able to eat a few. Now, we're all aware of the fact that this world can be extremely vicious. Here's that iconic photograph. I doubt that anyone in this room has not seen it, you know, less than 50 or 100 times probably. From out of the depths of what we refer to now as the Great Depression, this photograph of this mother, a young mother who, because of the starvation and circumstances of the time, is much older appearing than she actually was, became emblematic for us of the hardships of that time. But in every country, in rotating through various times, perhaps even not on a national level, but on an individual level, we all of us are going to face circumstances that are just absolutely unfair. Solomon would say that he saw, and remember he saw this from personal experience as well as from divine revelation, that life under the sun doesn't always go the way you think it would. Those who are the fastest, the most fleet of foot, do not always win the race. He put it, the race is not to the swift. He also noticed that not always the best outfitted, the strongest, and better trained of any given army might win the battle. It might go the other way for circumstances as simple as a spring rain that happened to favor one of the armies over the other. The battle is not necessarily, he's pointing out, to the warriors. Neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. You may be the fastest person the world ever saw. Mary Decker comes to mind, but some 20 years ago, her face became iconic for having stumbled, another person collided with her. You know, she didn't win the race. The battle's not to the warriors. We didn't learn that in Vietnam. You know, we didn't learn much from all of that experience. Bread to the wise. Some of the wisest, some of the smartest people you'll ever see can't make a living. I've marveled at that through the years. I can think of a couple of men now, some of the smartest I've ever known, and just don't succeed in this life. Nor wealth to the discerning, favor to men of ability. Time and chance, brethren, is just vicious. Time and chance will find anybody in these various categories the victim, failing, unable to achieve what they would hope for. This is life. And the wisest man who ever lived, Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and verse 11, pointed it out in a poetic manner that you see before you. This morning, in Psalms 3 and 4, we're going to think about that at some length. Before we do, there's a little bit of background that's necessary here. Sometimes, brethren, as I pointed out, we are innocent victims. And David, who was a man after God's own heart, knew what that was about. As a very young man, and for very many years, and in purity and wisdom as he was conducting his affairs, the king had singled him out, Saul, to destroy him. On 11 separate occasions, tried to kill him, as a matter of fact, when this young man was absolutely innocent. David knew what it was to be a victim of somebody else's misbehaving and to suffer despite the fact that he had done nothing to incur such difficulties. Or, brethren, we might bring it on ourselves and be quite deserving. David committed at least 3 spectacular sins that we know about. He committed adultery. He committed murder. And he numbered Israel in an act of rebellion that was just horrifying. This man, who God describes as being of similar heart and behavior to God himself, still had just cataclysmic failures, terrific mistakes that he made. and brought things upon himself in those cases that he really asked for, and that he had no right and didn't, you know, really complain about. For he recognized that he was guilty. But either way, brethren, it hurts, doesn't it? It's going to feel just as bad whether you're guilty or innocent. Either way, your mind is tormented, your flesh is aching or hurting, you are suffering for reasons that you may not even be able to understand. No matter what the circumstances, pain is pain, difficulty is difficulty, you're hurting. As we begin this morning to approach Psalm number 3, you need to know this about David's son. His firstborn, first child, was called Amnon, and he abused his half-sister as badly as any human being can abuse a woman. The third son, Absalom, full brother to the sister, murdered Amnon then as a result. And it's hard to blame him for it after what had taken place. He acted on his own. He shouldn't have done what he did. But nonetheless, you can certainly understand the outrage. Absalom, as a result, will be banished by his father from the kingdom for 3 years. They're not going to speak for 3 years. They're not going to live in that same house. They're not going to have anything but bad feelings because of this event. It was horrifying. But ultimately, David forgives the son that he still loves despite the horror of the way that he has behaved. This is just the way it is with parents, isn't it? I think I have yet to see anybody commit a crime that captures national or even world attention whose mother and father did not then go on the news to say, he's a good boy, he's a good girl, got caught up in this or caught up in that. I just don't think there's ever been an exception. Parents love their children. David could forgive Absalom, and after these 3 years in exile, he brought him home. And you know what happened? Absalom didn't appreciate it. Absalom had been plotting to bring this about. Absalom had designs on the kingdom. He rebelled against his father. And the next thing you know, David is back out in the wilderness like he had been when Saul, the king he had replaced, was persecuting him in his innocence. Unbelievable. How do you react to that? How should you feel about that? What should you do about that? If you are a man, or of course a woman, after God's own heart, Psalms numbers 3 and 4 will tell you, because David is going to spill his heart for us. As I pointed out in the previous lessons, we will have an indication at the start of Psalm 3 that this was written at the time that David was suffering these things. And because of these things, brethren, 20,000 Jews will die in the civil war that Absalom unleashes on the kingdom. Now, that's horrifying. And no matter what you've read in recent news, you know, no matter what you've experienced in your life, probably you've never been responsible for the death of 20,000 soldiers and others caught up in a civil war that's been unleashed because of the rape of a daughter by a son, you know, in circumstances like this that lead then to murder and to revolt. David was hurting when he wrote the third Psalm. That uninspired title, which reads like this in the New American Standard, a Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom his son, is in between these two events. As David in the dark of night is forced to leave his palace, his capital city, and his kingdom, he has many men and women and children who are forced out by night into that wilderness in haste and prepared for all of it, fleeing into that darkness. The suffering, the wailing, the crying, the fears that were provoked by all of that weigh awfully heavily on the heart of David. And while this is an uninspired designation, when he fled from Absalom his son,
as I have pointed out, we have seen these uninspired designations by inspired, corroboration have been claimed by God to have been the truth. And so this one likely is as well.
These are the circumstances when Psalm number 3 is written. They are about then being assailed with unspeakable adversity. These are times of experiencing horrors unimaginable, both mental, physical. This is the worst that it can get, I suppose. And here, apparently, prior to the 20,000 dying, but as the civil war is unfolding, David says this in Psalm 3, verses 1 and 2. He says, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. Try to imagine this bit. Now out in the wilderness, only the food that they could grab in a desperate bid to escape by night before Absalom would murder them all. Weary, dirty, and it'll be unwashed for days and weeks to come. Going through deprivation that has the highest contrast between King of Israel in my palace to this. Wandering around out amid the stones, of the wilderness with no shelter whatsoever. And what he does is to say to his God, here are the facts. He just states the case. And it's passionate. O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. And as a matter of fact, David himself must have harbored some of those thoughts. Wouldn't you? What is going on here? It does seem to be that there is no deliverance for me. It does not look that I'm likely to win in this altercation. My son has been plotting this for some time, and I am completely caught unawares. And he has raised his army and driven me from my own home. Now I'm out here, unprepared, surprised. What hope is there? What deliverance is there for me in my God? Brother, when you come to circumstances like this, follow David's lead. Declare those circumstances. Express them, how you feel about them. You'll note that in Psalm chapter 4 at verse 6, so it's not in the same order, but you have really the exact same thing. So in the adjoining psalm, he said, many are saying, who will show us good? Lift up the light of thy countenance upon us, O Lord. Lord, here are my circumstances. These are the things that I'm experiencing. This is what I'm upset about. This is what I do not understand. And as I look out there, I don't know what to do about it. And everybody else is looking at this, and they don't know what to do either. There does not seem to be any help from your hand, dear God. Now, in times of doubt like that, here, though, watch what happens in the next two verses. Troubled as he must be, David, though, is rising to this occasion, for he says in verses 3 and 4 of, again, Psalm 3, but you, O Lord, are a shield about me. Friend, at this moment in time, David doesn't hardly have a shield to his knee. But he says, God is my shield. He has not got a roof over his head. He's only got clothes on his back, and maybe a few you could stuff into a bag. But he says, you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. Now, God has answered David quite a few times in the past. But if that uninspired heading is true, and I think that it is, then at this moment, it doesn't look like God is a shield to him at all. it doesn't look like God is much of a mountain that he can climb up upon, and upon which could have, you know, a defensive, even an offensive position. It does not look like God has answered from that mountain or given him any help at all. But David declares it, doesn't he? It's when, brethren, you don't know what to do, when you're confused, when you're really hurting, just find out about your faith in your God. It's when you can't see any way out of this, when you don't seem to have the strength or the wisdom to cope with it, that you really start learning about your faith in your God. It is then that you are called upon to say what David said in Psalm 3 in verses 3 and 4, but what he also said in Psalm 4 at verse 3. Know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call. David's recognizing that God may not answer at the moment that I call, but I know he's listening. I have no doubt in my mind that he hears what I'm saying. When you skip in Psalm 4 to verse 7, you have put gladness in my heart more than when their grain and new wine abound. It is tough, brethren, in the absence of everything you love and upon which you depend, to say, I can be happy like people rejoice when they bring in their yearly harvest, when their annual income arrives, when they've got all the money in their hands they're going to have for the year, or all the provisions they'll put away against starvation into their barns. It's hard to do that. But David was a man after God's own heart. And you will recall that David has been trained by his circumstances, trained by the years of persecution from Saul, trained by the years of war against many surrounding nations, tribes, and cities, trained by the things that he had learned from his youth as he protected the flock, to know that God heard, that God does answer his own time, that he is a shield, that all will be well, that I can choose to be happy. James will say, count it all joy when you encounter various trials. David could, and he did, do that. Now we're called upon to do that. Perhaps you are suffering. Perhaps there are enormous constraints upon your time. Perhaps it is difficult for you to find the time or the physical strength, or maybe even the commitment to do more for your God and to resist sin and to devote yourself to his service first before yourself or anything else that goes on in your life. But you know you could. You know you can, because you see it in the life of David. And brothers, we pointed out in the introduction of these psalms a couple of weeks ago, this, I believe, certainly, is why these psalms are here. Psalms that reveal the emotion of the circumstances, that pour out the passion of the moment, and inform us then, instruct us, with regard to how that we too can behave, how we ought to feel in our hearts during such trying times as these. Understanding, of course, a few of us will never know anything like David was experiencing even in just this one event. Declare your unwavering confidence in the God who will rescue you. Then in verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 3, he says, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Brethren, the moment he penned those words, that's exactly what was going on. Armies were surrounding him, led by his son, to murder him and his family and his faithful few who still trusted him as the king of Israel. But brethren, more than just believing, you know, in God, believe it! State your confidence. And I lie awake all night to torment. You know, it's another step he took there, isn't it? David says, I'm going to go to sleep. And he did.
his eyes pop open in the morning. He says, I'm awake and I'm alive because God gave me this breath. So here is the man who carves the way for us. Here's the man who shows us how to part the waters, you know, figuratively, of the problems of our lives and just walk on through on that dry ground and say, you know, God is my shield. He's answered me before. He'll answer me now. Then God is in charge no matter what it is that I'm going through. We learn from the New Testament you can't be tempted beyond what you're able, but God will, with that temptation, provide the way of escape. David says, well, it's time to get a good night's sleep. Yes. What's your bedtime? 9:30, 10 o'clock? Time to just lay that weary head down. Verses 5 and 6, brethren, are a marvel in the midst of what David was experiencing. I lay down and slept. I awoke, and he gives a reason, brethren, for all three. I didn't sit up until I keeled over. I lay down. I didn't lie awake fretting about everything. I slept. And I awoke the next morning, he says in verse 5, for the Lord sustains me. And I'll suggest to you, you ought to look for this throughout the rest of the Psalms as we're studying them. David said he did these things. That word F-O-R attributes a reason. It gives you the why. Tells you the how. He says, I lay down, I slept, and I woke up. Verse 5, why? For the Lord sustains me. In other words, brethren, when you are driven to the point that you know you cannot sustain yourself, it is then that your faith will bear you up on eagle's wings. It is only when you have run out of your last resource, when you are utterly devoid of any means of either understanding or coping, it is then that God steps in to sustain you. Otherwise, it is you that is sustaining you. God will likely bring you more than once in the course of your life to that place where you can no longer sustain yourself, where you are helpless. It is then you discover your God. It is then you begin to learn about the power that he has for you. It is then you begin to understand what faith will do. It is then, brethren, that he sustains you when you do not. Those are amazing verses. 5 and 6. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. In Psalm 4, what did he say in verse 8? In peace, I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety. Safety? Safety? Yes, brethren, if God is your shield, nobody can penetrate that. If God is the shield that he said God was for him, why not lie down, let it go, relax and sleep? And in both Psalms, that's what I'm doing. God's taking care of it. You alone, Lord, make me to dwell in safety. At verse 7 then, brethren, you've got every right, though, to say, get me out of here. I don't like this. Don't want any more of it. So he says, arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all my enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. In the very first verse of Psalm 1, that's where he started, or Psalm 4, rather, that's where he started. Answer me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have delivered me in my distress. Be gracious to me, gracious, and hear my prayer. Pour it out. Not just, brethren, what your circumstances are and your unshakable confidence that God can handle them and the fact that you will trust him. You can relax and let him take care of the business. Even make your request. No, Lord, here's what I would like to have happen. Here's what I think is best. Here's my request. If it is thy grace and thy will, may it be so, my Father. So state your request. David will in 100 of these psalms. And then he will say one thing that's unique in chapter 3 between the two psalms, and one thing that is unique in Psalm number 4.
In verse 8, here is something he did not, in some other words, say over in the fourth Psalm. In verse 8, he closes out with this. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. Wondrous. For all that was going on in David's life,
he's still thinking not just of himself, but of everybody else as well. His concern, not just for him. How easy it would be, you know, to get all caught up in the why is me, or woe is me, you know, why is this happening to me, kind of an epic.
And now he just declares himself in Psalm 3. Salvation belongs to the Lord. This is a way of saying it does not belong to me. I'm helpless, but not hopeless. I am dependent, dear God. So he closes. Your blessing be upon your people. It sounds, brethren, like this may have been penned that very night
that he was driven out and Absalom was hot on his heels. It may have been written a day or two later. We don't know. It was in that interim right there.
David exited the psalm with praise for his God and an appeal for his people.
Excuse me.
And then in Psalm 4, in verses 2 through 5, this is unique to the fourth Psalm. You don't find it in the third. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? But know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. The Lord hears when I call. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord. Those words, brethren, I don't quite know what to do with.
This is one of those occasions where I can see two very different ideas that he might have in mind here. But as is the case, in virtually every place I've been able to find in Scripture in 40 years of looking, brethren, when you've got words that can be understood more than one way, and both ways are obviously true, and you can't answer the question, which one in this case was in David's mind or some other prophet's mind? And you can't tell. I suppose God may have done that because both are true. So as David is led by the Spirit here, make sure you see both of these ideas, though. Both of them appear to be true, and that's why you can't tell them apart. But often enough, we only see one. As soon as we recognize one idea, we quit looking, so we only see one. So at first blush, brethren, if you know it might be, I mean, as you're reading verses 2 and following, you're thinking in terms of God's admonition to the righteous. The other way to view it, and it'll depend, here at verse 2 it sounds more strongly like this, that it is to the unrighteous. Well, surely verse 2 is addressed to the unrighteous. O sons of men, how long will my honor become a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? So it might be, you know, certainly he's directed that only at those evil people who were persecuting, pursuing him in these days. Psalm 4 also may have been written at the same time. But then if he goes on, brethren, in verse 3, know that the Lord has set apart the godly man for himself. Well, that works equally well for a godly man as well as for an ungodly man. He could be saying this to the godly man, and you have confidence you're set apart for God. But he could be saying it still, as he did in verse 2, addressing it to the ungodly man. How long are you going to do this? Know this. The Lord sets apart the godly man for himself, and he hears when I call. You need to know this, you ungodly people. And usually by the time we get to verse 4, I believe in verses 4 and 5, we're thinking in terms of, well, he's shifted now, surely he's just talking to the righteous man. Tremble and do not sin. Meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifice of righteousness. Trust in the Lord. Why, it sounds like advice to the faithful. Not so sure. Could still be David saying to those unfaithful, know these things. It's something of a veiled threat, in fact. It's a warning. gal here, and I don't know how to pick one or the other. Keep them both in your mind. David may have started out in verse 2 and ended up in verse 5 thinking through all those verses about the ungodly. Or he may have started out in verse 2 and said something about the ungodly and slowly shifted until his viewpoint is toward the godly. Go either way. It's probably both. So, brethren, here's what you get from David. You get a pattern when you're facing adversity. Tell God what the circumstances are. Declare to him that bad as they are, you believe he'll handle it. Show him that you trust him. Get a decent night's sleep. Don't let yourself be tormented. Be anxious for nothing, Paul said. And then make your request. Praise your God. And then turn around, you know, and fight it. Looks to me in verses 2 through 5 is what he's doing. He is planting his feet to those unrighteous people, and he's saying, well, all right then. I've told you the way it is. Now come and get me, because I stand behind the shield of my God. Good luck with that. He's ready, and he did, and he won, and he'll take the throne back in his palace, in his capital city, and over his kingdom. And Absalom will die swinging by the hair of his head. You know the story. His own son. The army will be routed, and David will be king again. So, bad as it was, forced out that night by darkness to save the lives, and they primarily was concerned about the women and the children. He then turned and he planted both feet and said, all right, what's our vernacular? Bring it on. Bring it on. I'm a child of God. And if God is for me, then what? Who can be against me? Okay? This is David, Psalms 3 and 4. Appreciate your attention. I hope you can practice that pattern. Hope that all of us will become men and women after God's own heart and show Eugene what that means. For instance, in verse 2, oh, sons of Eugene, how long will the honor of Christians be a reproach? How long will you love what is worthless and aim at deception? Bring it on, because here we are and here we come. The Covered Road Church of Christ. We are ready for you.